Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Hi, everybody. It's Bob Bazanko, co-host of the Green and Red podcast. I'm going solo today. And we have, again, with us for, I don't know how many times, several times now, you've been on. One of my good friends and just an absolute great scholar, Iskander Siddiqui. Iskander is now a lecturer in international relations of the Middle East at the School of International Relations at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland, and the author of Revolution and Its Discontents, which is about the Iranian Revolution. Iskander has been doing a lot of media, especially in the past year or so. And we're going to kind of catch up on what's going on in Iran. I think the last time we spoke was right before the war began, or, you know, kind of right around that time, probably late February. So once again, thank you so much for joining us, Iskander.
No, great to see you.
And let's start, because we always start this way, right? You have people, you obviously know a lot of people who are still living in Iran. How are they doing? What's the situation there? What's the damage? Are they able to rebuild? I mean, what's happening?
I mean, it's obviously, you know, people are very relieved that we've seen like a formal end to hostilities, even though they keep obviously lingering. But it's obviously not now kind of a nationwide, you know, bombing campaign by the Israelis and the United States, of course. So, but yeah, I said a big sense of relief. But, you know, obviously there's been a huge amount of damage inflicted on the country, including kind of really important, like vital infrastructure, such as, you know, major bridges, but also sort of major sort of industrial infrastructure and sources of like foreign exchange revenue. So like major kind of sources of Iranian exports. So the Iranian steel industry in like Esfahan and Khuzestan, which was a major source of like non-oil like revenue for the country. You know, the capacity there has been very badly kind of damaged. Similarly, like petrochemicals, which Iran also kind of produced, you know, have been badly kind of, very badly damaged and were intentionally, you know, targeted by the Israelis. You had well over 100 cultural heritage sites, you know, damaged. You had 30 odd, you know, universities, many, many schools. Obviously, the very first strike was this horrendous attack on this school, girls' school in Minab, which led to the death of, you know, well in excess of 100, you know, people, including obviously, you know, overwhelmingly young girls. So yeah, I think people are largely kind of dealing with the fallout of that, dealing with obviously the losses in both material and also, you know, the human, of course. And, you know, on the other hand, there's also the economic situation, the broader kind of economic situation, which is difficult. One, because obviously there was the U.S. naval blockade, which, I mean, on the one hand, there was no doubt that the state could withstand this for quite a while. But at the same time, as is often the case, it's the same like with sanctions policy, you know, the people who are overwhelmingly impacted and hurt are generally, you know, the more vulnerable in society. So as a result of that, you know, again, Iran was managing, you didn't have any food shortages, you had well-stocked shelves, you had all of these sorts of things, but there was a case of, you know, prices literally changing during the course of the day, like, you know, massively kind of shooting up. So you had sort of runaway inflation, you know, about 2 million people maybe have lost their jobs as a result. And, you know, and obviously these are things which are hopefully going to improve rather quickly. But obviously, yeah, this is taking a toll. But yeah, fortunately, the conflict is over. And I think people, like I said, are relieved about that.
So there really aren't like food shortages or right now, like people are able to get like kind of at least the necessities.
Yeah. No, necessities, I don't think, are a problem.
Is Iran mostly kind of like, I don't know, self-reliance, the word, but I mean, does it kind of, you know, produce a lot of the foods and basic?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, in terms of like a lot of staples, it's large. I mean, don't worry, it does obviously import food, but yeah, it does have a very significant domestic agricultural industry, and a lot of it's actually in the hands of smaller farmers and so on. So there is actually a significant degree of actually flexibility in that respect. And so, yeah, I mean, again, I was speaking with relatives
Yeah,
like
no.
3 hours following news. Yeah. But so there is a significant degree of food reliance, which, I mean, it has other issues which we could maybe get into, but that's more of a sort of a digression. But no, in that respect, it's been okay. It's been more the prices,
Well, yeah, sure.
which has been kind of a significant kind of obstacle and issue.
You know, it seems like in planning for this, the US and Israel assumed like just a really rapid collapse. Like, were they just unaware of like kind of the conditions inside Iran, or they just assumed their own power would overwhelm it, or?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, you'll have a lot of insight into how the US security state like functions, but my sense at least was that, you know, there are clearly people in, you know, the Pentagon and the State Department who have a more realistic appraisal, right? Who do have a sense of, yeah, no, Iran has these vulnerabilities, but it also has these very has this capacity for like real resilience. And I mean, just take the case of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz. Like everyone and their uncle knew that that was a very real possibility. I mean, it's not a surprise. I mean, if you had followed this even peripherally, I mean, everybody knew that. But then, why did the Trump administration, or Trump himself, not take that seriously? And where did this sort of hubris come in? And how did that inform then the decision-making process? Both in Israel and the United States. And that's a kind of a question maybe we can talk about. But yeah, I clearly think the people within the American state and the Israeli state had some idea about this, and maybe weren't so hubristic. Because I mean, again, anybody who followed again and has any understanding of the Iranian state would understand that it's not a sort of a personalistic dictatorship that you just take, you know, cut the head and everything is simply just going to fall by the wayside. And you know, power is very dispersed. There are multiple centers of power. Of course, there's some centers which are more powerful than others and might have an outsized influence, but they're not just hostage to one individual. And if anything, you know, when for instance the leader of Iran was assassinated in the way that he was, in many ways it consolidated and gave a greater kind of coherence to the Islamic Republic elite to kind of resist sort of American and Israeli kind of aggression. And it kind of, in many ways, gave a coherence to his legacy as well, that he was kind of, you know, in 100 years, he's, you know, maybe sort of, you know, I struggle to find a comparable example even of a sort of an Iranian leader that has been killed on Iranian soil at the hands of a foreign aggressor and invader. So, in many ways, yeah, we saw the reverse of the intended outcome, and fortunately, and we saw, as we would expect, a kind of rally around the flag effect to a significant extent. But particularly, I would say, like amongst the Islamic Republic's like core base of support, which is not negligible, you saw it really re-energized, actually. I mean, and we've seen kind of a massive mobilization nationwide throughout the entire country of supporters of the Islamic Republic, and also, you know, some people who are, you know, patriotic as well, and maybe don't necessarily conform to what we might expect a supporter of the system might look like. But you know, young women without hijab, young women who kind of actually re wearing kind of very kind of, I guess, yeah, I mean, jeans and like a loose t-shirt or whatever. I'm going into the streets and actually participating in these rallies. But what we've seen is like nationwide mobilization, basically supporting the resistance against, you know, the Israeli-American aggression, and really kind of even sometimes actually pushing even the negotiators to take a harder line, actually. So yeah, I mean, it did very much, there was very much a backlash. It did not work out how they foresaw. I mean, the way I sort of understood it, I mean, the way I'm sort of, or trying to make sense of it, is that, and I think a lot of people have said this as well, that obviously coming off Venezuela, Trump really did have this sense of complete impunity, and had the sense that he can just use American power to remake entire countries and regions in accordance with his will. And given that the Venezuela operation was really so frictionless, in a way, he was very, in a sense, primed to believe the narrative that had been spun by Netanyahu and I guess those sort of outriders in Washington who are basically, in many ways, Israeli surrogates, and basically big advocates of the Israeli kind of agenda. And Netanyahu has his own reasons and motivations, obviously, for pursuing. So this is something which he has obviously pursued for decades and decades, and had tried multiple administrations who had taken very kind of aggressive postures and aggressive stances with respect to Iran, but had never taken that step of actually, full-blown kind of attack. And he obviously, in Trump, he found the person who was primed and ready to basically to execute and carry this out.
The so-called experts in the U.S., did actually see a lot of that coming, but they were like, the State Department just got rid of people beforehand. It's kind of what they did in with China in the 40s and 50s, right? The Strait of Hormuz, I mean, I used to show that in my classes and just put a map up, and that's pretty easy to understand. And Trump was told, we know at the meetings, and even the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said, they're gonna close Hormuz. So they should have seen that coming, right? Obviously, right? And even the response, right? If you study war, anytime a country is besieged like that, they tend to rally and kind of, one thing though, even that kind of surprised me a bit was the Iranian military response, right? I mean, the drone defenses were amazing, right? And not only that, but kind of the long range attacks. I mean, they attacked pretty much every other state in the region. Was that, I mean, is that something you anticipated beforehand? Or, because I think
I mean,
that was, I don't mean impressive in the sense, well, I kind of was, anytime you're taking on imperialism, but that was pretty impressive what they
For
did,
sure. No, absolutely. I mean, I know that, I mean, so these are threats which have been made for a significant period of time. And actually, just before the war began, like Ayatollah Khamenei, the late supreme leader of Iran, like said, he said, if they attack again, and it's obviously coming off the June War of 2025, then it will be a regional war. I mean, very explicitly said this, and I think that a lot of regional states did understand this. I mean, this actually, I think this also explains why, for instance, Qatar and Oman were so kind of proactive before the war began, and the Omani foreign minister went on, I think, Face the Nation and said very clearly, this is the best deal imaginable, or the best deal that we could possibly get. It in many ways surpasses the JCPOA, etc., so on and so forth, right? Because I think they understood that. So I think there's two things which do stand out for me. One is actually not only the fact that they managed to, because in a sense they didn't actually fully close the Strait of Hormuz, right? They basically blocked and stopped basically vessels transiting, but they allowed some vessels, so like Iranian tankers and also some friendly states, they also allowed them to transit through. So I think, like, and I've said this elsewhere, like the degree of control in that first period preceding the blockade was really, I do think that was impressive. I think nobody actually anticipated that. I think that was quite something, actually, because Iran was actually in the early phases, despite obviously sustaining huge amounts of damage, its oil revenue shot up because obviously oil prices were going up, and it was still exporting when many other countries were not. So I think that was actually a quite remarkable like achievement just from like a purely kind of strategic military perspective. Then yes, similarly, I mean, and of course, the United States military, we can't trust a word that they say. They actually denied, obviously, the extent of the damage, right, on American bases, and then it took weeks and weeks and weeks to really understood, these 15 or so bases that had many had been like destroyed were now unusable. And I think like I had anticipated it, but again, I think the thing is, the actual execution, right? I mean, I think this is a big thing that war, in a sense, it really shows where power lies and how it can be exercised in a really kind of concrete way. It's no longer kind of this abstraction of like, we'll do this if you do this and threats. It was really kind of executed. So, I mean, again, even with the Strait of Hormuz, I mean, we thought, definitely they're going to try to do that, but will they be able to do that? How will they be able to do that? Will they be able to do it in the face of, the biggest US naval buildup in the region, like, I mean, since the Iraq War, and in some senses, like exceeding that, right? So these sort of huge logistical kind of movements into the region, would Iran be able to nevertheless enforce this? And it did. I mean, that's really what this war, I think, has shown that, and showed that Iran did have leverage in a way that you could, many of these sort of war hawks and war, and these think tanks in sort of Washington, D.C. for years have said, yeah, the Iranians threaten this, but they can't really do it. They've got this third-rate kind of force, etc. You know, it's battered by sanctions and embargoes, but they can't really do this, even if they're making these threats. And obviously, this war showed that no, Iran can do it. It can follow through, and it followed through on it. And it exacted a real cost, not just on the US, but obviously on the global economy. And also, yeah, the US presence in the region. I mean, and there is this real question, like, will these Gulf states, because now foot the bill to rebuild this American sort of military sort of infrastructure throughout the region, which in many respects, put a target on their back and made them vulnerable to Iranian counterattack, right? So that's a real kind of question, and I don't think it's settled. I mean, some people think, oh no, they're definitely going to be easily reintegrated and folded back in, but you know, I think there's real questions about that, and especially when we look at countries like Saudi Arabia, that you know, a very kind of stalwart American ally historically. I mean, they've increasingly been kind of hedging in certain respects as well with respect to China and Russia and so on, and we'll probably see similar things in some other states, not the UAE or Bahrain, but in some of the cases we will see that. So anyway, I do think this, you know, there's, you know, a lot of people have said, you know, this Iran clearly won this. And again, how do we understand victory and winning, etc.? But I mean, there's no doubt that Iran has come out with a huge amount of leverage and in a strong position, as long as, you know, it's able to now transform this strategic victory into kind of a political, economic kind of win, for sure.
One thing that I think was really impressive, one of the impressive elements, was the way I called it kind of a rope-a-dope, where Iran, apparently ahead of the war, essentially knew that they could kind of force the United States to use a significant proportion of its stock, and it has. I mean, apparently the United States weapons reserve has gone down like half or something like that, right? So they were kind of, I think they understood, you know, we'll let them just, you know, bomb us, and you know, they're gonna get worn out, which was kind of what happened. I think the shock in America was really, you know, misplaced. Obviously, they should have seen some of this coming. But at the same time, Iran did things that, you know, and I follow it closer than most Americans, that really surprised me. So, but as
Yeah,
you
I mean,
said, like,
did you see this report from CNN even that was talking about the F-15s being swarmed with this sort of drone formation? I mean, we saw a lot of things which I don't think many of us maybe had the full knowledge of or cognizance of or expected. And I think, like, I mean, I knew obviously, and I had read about it and I researched it for quite a while, like the development of these asymmetric strategies, both with the axis of resistance and then also with respect to the Revolutionary Guard. And this is obviously was itself forged through, yeah, the sort of long campaign of American economic warfare and isolation, you know, and so on. And the fact that, you know, if you look at prior to the revolution, the degree to which the Iranian military was completely dependent on American supply chains, etc. And they sort of have been weaning themselves off that really from 1980 onwards, and really developed a very coherent doctrine in its stead. I think just the question was like, will this be able to really withstand American empire? We've seen it in other theaters in the region, right? But like in Iraq during the American occupation, so on and so forth. But like on this level, where when I do think, you know, the Americans really and the Israelis threw everything at it to the point, like as you were sort of saying, they were like basically taking ammunitions from East Asia and like South Korea and like and other places which are really kind of see them, you know, very much dependent on this American security umbrella. And redeploying them to the Persian Gulf, and again, it did not come up trumps, and it didn't break the will of the Iranian like state. It just didn't. Yeah.
Yeah, I know. You know, there are tech nerds here in the U.S. who were, you know, kind of shocked at some of the stuff that Iran was showing. You know, I think to kind of, because before we were talking about Venezuela, the difference here is like Venezuela obviously didn't see anything coming or wasn't prepared at all, and it's a very different place than Iran. In Iran, you know, like, you know, understood the United States was this hostile country just, you know, last summer. So, but even with that preparation, I think what they've done is really quite remarkable. One more thing, you know, because I want to talk obviously about the MOU and what's happening now, but because a couple times you've mentioned like the Revolutionary Guard and the political situation, and again here in the United States we get kind of, you know, like it's a dictatorship or the Revolutionary Guard is running everything or the hardliners are here and the negotiators are there. What's actually happening? How are these decisions being made in Tehran? How is, kind of is there kind of any fracture within, let's just call it the Iranian ruling class or the policymakers, anything like that?
Yeah, I mean, there are clear divisions. But maybe we should speak first about actually the decision-making process. Best we understand it. So there is a Supreme National Security Council, which is like the key decision-making body for national security policy, basically. And there you have, key representatives from the Revolutionary Guard, from the parliament, from the government, so the president, the speaker of parliament, it was Mohammed Bakir Khalibaf, and so on and so forth. And so it's a mechanism for building consensus within the key kind of branches and organs of the Iranian state. So they'll come together and they'll basically evaluate, and they will quite vigorously debate this. And of course, then there's also, this is very much in then in liaising with and in contact with the leader of Iran, Ayatollah Mujtaba Khamenei, who is the son of obviously of the late leader. And I mean, the reality there is that we haven't heard his voice, and we haven't seen any video footage of him since the assassination of his father and his wife and child and so on. So and I was listening to an interview with a relative of his on an Iranian news channel, and he was saying that it's because of, I mean, again, we're only going on the basis of, sort of the bits and pieces which we're able to patch together, but he was sort of saying it's because of real security reasons and not wanting to have any expose himself to the, danger of assassination, which, as we've seen with the Israelis, I mean, are very, very happy to do that. And most likely would like to assassinate, I mean, they've actually threatened to assassinate the leader of Iran again, because also they know that would then implode, the MOU and any kind of diplomatic track with the United States. So, but anyway, in terms of decision making, that is the key body that makes decisions, right? But beyond that, obviously you have different factions within the Iranian state. So you have those who are more sort of, you could say, center right technocratic, right? And they're very much keen on basically getting the economy running again. And often they're the biggest advocates of engagement and normalization with the West for the most part, right? And they're a powerful faction within the state, and people like Hassan Rouhani, so the former president who was elected first in 2013, he's sort of seen as a key figure in that constellation. And then you have others like Mohammed Bakir Ghalibaf, who is the Speaker of Parliament, who is called a principalist, so they're called like the Osudgaro, so the principalist faction, who are, you could say, I mean, I don't really like the term hardline, but yeah, in some sense, they're a bit more, but he's sort of seen as a pragmatic principalist, he seems quite pragmatic. He was formerly the mayor of Tehran. He did a lot of kind of initiatives in terms of like economic development. He was kind of very interested in the Chinese model and so on. And he's a pragmatic individual, but he's also a former he's formerly in the Revolutionary Guard, which, to be honest, I mean, you often see this in Western media that, oh, so and so is formerly in the Revolutionary Guard. It really doesn't mean anything. I mean, to be honest, I mean, actually, I shouldn't say it doesn't mean anything, but it's often exaggerated. I mean, how significant it is. It's a bit like, in the United States, like members of Congress or politicians who served in the US military, right? It's sort of got that. So they do have connections to that institution, but it doesn't mean they're sort of necessarily just representative of anything that institution says. And similarly, the Revolutionary Guard isn't like a single voice. I mean, there are different like voices and factions within that as well. And on the other side, the final sort of, I would say, probably the more radical, they call themselves Enqilabi, so like the revolutionary, but they're also kind of a form of principalist, but they're usually seen as the hardest line, as it were. They're called Jabhe Paydari, so like maybe the endurance front in Iran, and they're kind of advocating for, yeah, the MOU is a mistake, that Iran should have actually continued to close the Strait of Hormuz, and it should under no circumstances have given sort of anything, any concessions whatsoever to the United States. So that's the ongoing debate like within the state, and obviously the Supreme National Security Council is, I guess, managing these different demands. And each of these have their own maybe grassroots support. So maybe the Rouhani faction is more in tune with what the middle class broadly wants up to a point. Jeppe Paidori. I mean, it's complex because on the one hand, I guess there's elements within powerful elements within the state who are aligned with them, but they also do have their own constituency, and as does Gali Baf and others, right? So the ultimate decision maker is the Supreme National Security Council, and for the minute, obviously, they're negotiating this thing. They're the ones who negotiated the MOU, and Abbas Araghchi, the foreign minister, and Mohamed Bakr Gali Baf are the lead kind of negotiators with the Americans at the minute.
That negotiating team seems pretty impressive. The head of it, the foreign minister, Araghchi. I'm just kind of curious, what's his background? Because
He's an
he's very
interesting
impressive.
character, actually. He has a PhD from the University of Kent on like Islamic political thought, and he did his PhD with David McLennan.
I know the name, yeah.
He's a big scholar of Marx. He basically edited
Yeah.
like these like
Yeah.
Marxist writings and stuff. So he did his PhD at the University of Kent. Then I think obviously this is later. Before that, he was a young man like many. He served in the Revolutionary Guard in defending, basically in the war against Iraq, and then he was very much a kind of a foreign ministry official, and he served in previous governments. So he actually served in the same negotiating team which negotiated the JCPOA. But he's seen as not as so unlike maybe like Javad Zarif, who is seen as maybe too aligned partisan and close to maybe the more technocratic reformist factions. Araghchi is seen as more of a kind of acceptable figure to different factions, basically.
Okay.
So he's very much aligned with and in tune with the military as well, but he's also obviously practical on that side. So he's definitely he was just in Iraq today, and I saw he went to actually again very symbolically and very actually notably he went to the shrine of Imam Hussein, so the grandson of the prophet that was martyred to Karbala, which is a very kind of like foundational event in the history of Shia Islam, right? So he's very very clear in terms of the optics there. And Muhammad Ghali Baf, similarly, he was in the Air Force during the war, and he's an impressive figure in terms of like he's controversial politically because he's kind of accused of, neoliberalizing the city. He's also seen as maybe implicated in some kind of like untoward financial sort of dealings. But he again, he's clearly very capable and practical, and very kind of obviously able to get a real tangible kind of result in these negotiations. So he's similarly kind of broadly, I would say, trusted, but he's getting a lot of flack from the kind of the more hardline anti-negotiations wing. So they're really kind of going for him big time, him and Araghchi. And they're sort of trying to claim that there's daylight between the negotiating team and the kind of the leader's position. So they're sort of trying to kind of apply pressure to. So basically, the negotiators take a much kind of stronger line, which I think, to be honest, I can't see how they could at the minute. I mean, I think the MOU speaks for itself, and I think it is a really it's you know obviously we shouldn't over egg it and we shouldn't exaggerate because it is just a memorandum of understanding. It's not a treaty or anything approaching that, and it could just completely unravel, right? But I think getting these concessions from this administration or these acknowledgements, is very, very notable. And we just have to see whether they're able to actually cash it out, because obviously there's a huge amount of opposition internally in the United States as well as in Israel, as well as within Iran as well. There's a lot of criticism. So it's really kind of threading that needle is going to be extremely difficult.
I want to talk about that, but one last thing on this, because the Iranian negotiators really seem to understand American political culture better than most Americans do. Is that kind of like, is that emphasized in like kind of in Iranian, not just political circles, but in education as well? Is that kind of a, you know,
No, I mean, it's been an interesting kind of development. I think it just does show there has been a lot of savviness in lots of respects. I mean, on the one hand, if you read like Mohamed Bakr Ghalibaf's tweets, so when he's kind of like trolling Trump and talking about like the financial markets or the oil markets, it is clearly how these are being written and produced. I don't have the faintest idea, but I think like it clearly shows like really very good message discipline, very much kind of they're appealing to they kind of have an audience in mind, and they're kind of to not just like the American public, but world opinion as well. And they've been really, really like savvy, basically. And it's the same with a lot of the kind of war propaganda. So like around these sort of Lego videos,
Oh,
you
those are
know.
brilliant. That's
So
amazing. Yeah.
which again, which shows like, and people like, various scholars have who work a lot on particular, I guess, media have like been tracing, I guess, the development of Iranian media, which maybe previously in previous decades was, quite austere, quite like dogmatic maybe, and quite predictable, whereas now it shows again like real sort of versatility. And I think this is something which and unpredictability, I actually think this is something which the Iranian negotiators have really, and like the Iranian elite have kind of cottoned onto, because like Trump himself like would always really pride himself on being, unpredictable, right?
Yeah.
And I think that the sort of the political class in Iran and the people anyway who are in the forefront of this, they understand that they need to be equally sort of unpredictable in order to sort of get the US sort of, offside, and to sort of to basically get them imbalanced, really. And I think that's it's been very, very kind of impressive, I think. And I think there was an opinion piece in the New York Times by Arthur de Moivany, which was kind of looking at how sort of Iran's resistance of this American-Israeli aggression has been received and perceived, like not only in the Muslim world, but more broadly, like across the global South and just global public opinion. And it has been, overwhelming. There's been lots of people obviously rooting for Iran, and clearly do understand that this was a war of choice and a war of aggression. And Iran has effectively, it's kind of understand the sort of global lingua franca, global lexicon, and also like American as well. So I mean, the stuff, ridiculing Hegseth for being an alcoholic and an
Oh, yeah.
incompetent, and so many other things. So no, I do think we have seen a real change, and obviously some have made the argument that some of this is because obviously some of the top echelons of the leadership have been killed, and this has in a sense created a kind of a shuffling in key areas of the Iranian state, where you have a kind of a younger set of individuals who have grown up, have only ever known the Islamic Republic, but are also very familiar with, global kind of cultural lexicons and so on, and therefore have used that again very effectively, to sort of make Iran's case to the world.
Yeah, because here, Trump will bluff and bluster, and the Democratic Party will like run away frightened and give him whatever he wants, whereas like he's threatening to like ending a civilization, and I think the Iranians just realize like this is a crazy old man who wears diapers, and I think they've kind of offered a template to the world because even the Europeans will cave in to Trump, and the Iranians, they it's almost like they don't take him seriously, which, kind of it's sort of like the Vietnamese diplomacy during the Vietnam War. They would like, the United States would say, we have this, we have that. And Ho Chi Minh wouldn't blink, the Vietnamese negotiator would make it. Anyway, so about 38 times Trump has said the war is over, right? And each time the market went up, right? But that's another story. But we do have this kind of memorandum of understanding now, right? And as you pointed out, I think this is really important. In the United States, I think the American people never supported this war by huge numbers. They want it over. I think in a lot of people's minds, it's over. They've kind of moved on. But there are significant groups in the US, obviously the AIPAC associated groups, the Democratic leadership, certain members of the Republican Party. There's even like space between Lindsey Graham and Trump on this because usually they're attached at the whatever, right? So, and the basic line in the US is that they gave away too much, that Iran played Trump. Do you want to just kind of talk about like what that included in terms of sanctions relief and assets and maybe reparations or reconstruction money? And I don't know how much you want to talk about this, but I think one thing, again, that the US isn't, US media is not talking about enough is the role of Lebanon in all this.
No,
So just like
totally.
the MOU, just kind of generically.
Yeah, no, for sure. So, I mean, obviously, it led to this immediate and permanent termination of military operations on all fronts, including Lebanon. So, I think that is quite remarkable. Like, yeah, you flagged it, because it actually talks about the territorial integrity and sovereignty of Lebanon. So, I mean, I think a lot of people have understood that that is quite remarkable insofar as it sort of shows that Iran has been able to sort of exercise its leverage. Or is trying to anyway, to even beyond Iran into Lebanon itself. Well, obviously Lebanon is dealing with a horrendous kind of ongoing campaign of essentially ethnic cleansing in the south, and just the systematic sort of demolition of village after village after village, and the outright actually persecution of Shia Lebanese, right? But the fact that Iran could, and the United States agreed on paper. Obviously, the problem with all of this, and it's the same with, the so-called ceasefire in Gaza, where more than 1,000 Palestinians have been killed since the ceasefire. I mean, and the same with the ceasefire that was declared in Lebanon previously, is that, yeah, I mean, what do these ultimately count for if basically the Israelis are constantly just violating these at will and killing Palestinians and Lebanese at will? But Iran has actually tried to, to enforce this. I mean, it sort of said we're going to walk away or we're going to do this, and it has actually at certain times compelled Trump, at least, rhetorically. I mean, we don't really know what's maybe happening between him and Netanyahu, but to signal that this kind of needs to stop. And there has been, in some sense, unprecedented criticism of Israel by the Trump administration, which is, of course, notable. I mean, again, one has to be careful, separate the wheat from the chaff, and look what's really happening on the ground, of course. But these aren't inconsequential. Like, I don't think these are inconsequential. I think that's like a major thing. I think, yeah, the US and the Islamic Republic will respect each other's sovereignty, so the recognition of Iranian sovereignty. So, I mean, we should not forget this was a regime change war. I mean, this was what they wanted to do, and he blatantly proclaimed it as such, as did Netanyahu. They wanted to basically decapitate the state, then they wanted to induce a civil war in that country. The Israelis, in particular, wanted to basically support Kurdish like armed militias, and I remember at the time they were systematically bombing the border with Iraq. And checkpoints and things like this, and actually the security like installations and facilities, because they wanted to basically, and it would have been a disaster still, but this is what they wanted. They wanted to basically stir the pot and create a civil war. I mean, this is what they wanted to do.
But Trump admitted it.
He
Trump
admitted
admitted it
it.
publicly,
He admitted it, exactly. He
yeah.
admitted it. I mean, there's nothing to even debate. I mean, he plainly admitted it. So, I mean, that is, clear as day. I mean, obviously the things that, I mean, in terms of obviously then, the naval blockade, there was this agreement to remove the naval blockade. Iran's going to obviously allow transit through the Strait of Hormuz. That's obviously still kind of in a rather precarious state, even though I read this morning that there has been again an agreement to de-escalate. But I think that was about basically Iran, as far as I understand and can see, has said that no, we are going to our spoils from this war and the damage that has been inflicted on this country of, $300 billion or so worth of damage, we're going to now control in some capacity the Strait of Hormuz and the transit through it, and we're gonna get fees as a result of this. We can call them, management fees. We can call it whatever, insurance fees, whatever you want to do, and we're going to do that with the Omanis. And the Iranians have constantly tried to pull in the Omanis, because obviously they share this waterway with Oman and their territorial waters on both sides. Even though obviously you're reading the Western press that, this is a violation of the UN law of the sea, and all, which Iran isn't a signatory to anyway. But so, I mean, Iran has decided, and again, I'll let international lawyers, hash that out, but it's beyond my expertise. But like, it's very clear that politically the decision has been made that, although Iran isn't charging anything for transit to the minute, that after the 60 days or whenever this final deal is concluded, there is going to be some kind of financial remuneration. And I think as a result of that, Iran has basically been insisting that all ships transit on the Iranian side, on the side of the Iranian coast, which, normally, I mean, they would often have to dock on the Iranian side because of the deeper waters and so on. But Iran is obviously trying to create this precedent where any basically vessel which doesn't transit on the Iranian side is seen as potentially hostile. And this is a way of trying to, I guess, institutionalize and entrench its kind of de facto control, and hopefully to turn that into like a de jure control with Oman over the strait. And the Americans obviously don't want this. I mean, Trump is obviously, we've seen from both Trump and Rubio saying, no, there's no way this is going to happen. We saw Rubio go to the Gulf very recently. And clearly, I'm sure the Emiratis, the Kuwaitis, the Bahrainis, and others are making a lot of, noise and complaining a lot about this. But this is the, when you lose a war, this is sort of the new settlement, as it were. And it's quite interesting. In the MOU, it even actually names the Sultan of Oman. So it says that Iran is basically in this period going to conduct dialogue with the Sultanate of Oman, to define the future administration and maritime services of the Strait of Hormuz. Right. Then there's this kind of sort of investment fund for reconstruction, which I think, like, very disingenuously, Democrats and others who are hostile to Trump are trying to weaponize this as if he's given this money. They haven't given Iran anything, zip, like nothing. And it's I and I think like the Americans, I mean, it's a kind of a clever way for the Americans not to give Iran any money, but have some sort of promise of maybe some money will be forthcoming via like regional allies of the United States. And that might, it might materialize in some capacity. I mean, maybe the Gulf states themselves will think, okay, if we want to insure ourselves against future attacks on our infrastructure, which we can't possibly, shoulder and deal with, then we will invest in Iran in some capacity, and this maybe gets us actually, this probably will get us more protection than actually buying Trump or gifting Trump this $300 billion, sorry, $300 million plane, and so for Air Force One and all of
Yeah.
that. So that sort of development fund, I think, is very much up in the air, but it has been weaponized, I think, very disingenuously. The nuclear file, which we can maybe talk about, but that's been very much kicked down. That's been kicked into the long grass, kind of, even though they are like negotiating it more seriously now. But there is no sort of fine. I mean, obviously, there's this declaration that Iran will not pursue a nuclear weapon, which has always been Iran's official position. I mean, it was even sort of enshrined by a fatwa by the late Supreme Leader, which obviously is no longer in effect. So there's that. But yeah, the US obviously has promised to, to remove all sanctions if and when they basically reach this. So it says, yeah, the point seven is the United States of America undertakes to terminate all types of sanctions against the Islamic Republic of Iran, including the UN Security Council resolutions, which, go back to the 2000s, when Iran's nuclear program was first really, really kind of securitized, as well as all unilateral US sanctions, primary, secondary, and agreed upon schedule. So that's very much still open. That is not, that hasn't been decided. The thing that actually is, which has been agreed upon though, is that we have seen a termination of sanctions, and various waivers, which could obviously be very easily reimposed for the export of Iranian crude oil, petroleum products and derivatives, all associated services, including banking transactions, insurance and transportation. So that is a big win. That means that, anybody can buy Iranian oil in dollars. So obviously, for those who aren't aware, I mean, since 2012 and then under Obama, this began. Basically, the US pursued a really aggressive policy of financial strangulation, whereby Iran was cut off from the SWIFT payment system. It was basically prevented from basically using dollars, and none of its banks, and basically none of its banks could. And similarly, any sort of company or foreign bank which wanted to do business with Iran basically couldn't, because they would basically, get this massive like $1 billion fine from the treasury. So it created this horrendous impact on the Iranian economy and Iranian political economy. And I've written something fairly recently on this, kind of trying to how we can understand the kind of the relationship between economic warfare and the war that obviously broke out more recently, and how they're deeply kind of intertwined for this website called Phenomenal World. It's called Mosaic of Deterrence. It's a kind of a longer piece, and I'm working on a longer article now, which is kind of more systematically kind of going through that. But I think that is a big, obviously, gain, and that's going to allow Iran to, again, get a lot of more revenue in the short term. But then again, how, I mean, these are all things which are very easily reversible. Right. I mean, if it really comes to naught, then but again, it's very significant, for sure. Absolutely. So I think those are kind of the, if, as far as I can recall, these are the main things. There is this, obviously, there's this promise that this will be then ratified by the UN Security Council, but I think we're still quite a way off that, and we really just have to see, how these negotiations do kind of progress. So we have obviously this 60-day window, which can be extended. Vance obviously had this. There was a summit in Switzerland, which seemed at moments there was, they were. They did seem there were some obstacles, and there were some moments in which actually Trump basically threatened to murder the Iranian negotiators as well. Which, I guess, these kind of fulminations aren't really, we're not really, we're desensitized to them in part. And I guess I think, like what you said, regarding Iranian negotiators, I think for the most part, they are looking at the facts on the ground, and that's the hard reality. They're not really paying attention to all of the rantings and ravings of the clearly this very like unstable individual. But I think that's where we are. We have to see like where this goes. And Vance, was quite upbeat, but it's always hard to know like where sort of the propaganda and sort of the signaling to the markets versus like the reality. But I think the fact that both sides, I do think the Trump government does kind of want to be rid of this. I mean,
Oh,
if we do,
absolutely.
yeah, it does want to be rid of it. I think it is a huge headache for him. It's gonna encroach on everything else. And similarly, I think the overwhelming majority, both the Iranian public and also within the leadership, I would say there is a broad majority, even though of course there are outliers who do want a deal too, but on terms which. Yeah, which are acceptable, and I think this is the process where they're working through that. But yeah, if you trust what Vance has said, in some sense, this level of negotiations are kind of historic. They are kind of unprecedented. He even sort of mentioned, and again, I don't know how seriously to take some of this, but he was even sort of saying that the Revolutionary Guards are now directly in touch with the Emiratis, and they've set up this sort of mechanism now for deconfliction in both Lebanon and similarly to oversee kind of the sort of what's going on in Hormuz as well. And these are quite significant. These means that like top echelons of like the military in Iran are maybe even talking to CENTCOM possibly as well. Things like this, or at least there's some degree of communication, which again previously just would never have been the case. So yeah, I think this is really a notable document. It's just again whether this is converted into long, durable kind of peace, in some sense, even if it's sort of kind of a cold peace, and they don't, so that's what we have to sort of wait and see.
You know, any kind of war is cataclysmic, right? But at least at the end, if you want, you can find something coming. Like in Vietnam, at least you could say, well, the Vietnamese revolution succeeded. Here's something. Here. In this, there's no silver lining. I mean, it was, this kind of war, which was highly destructive to everyone involved, which makes me wonder, like, what did the other Gulf states, the Arab states, think of this, and did they have a role in kind of pushing the U.S. to say, get this over with? Because what. Again, I don't know how, but they didn't see this coming, right? With these attacks on the UAE, on Bahrain, on and not just on military attacks, but on hotels. And Iran has said everything that Elon Musk owns in the world is a legitimate target now, right? How what's happened there? Do you think they've kind of played a role in saying we got to get this over with? Because you, I've heard these public statements even by people in Bahrain and UAE saying we can't really count on the United States anymore.
No, totally. I mean, I think they were, I mean, obviously there's this sort of the all these there's this deep sort of highly troubling financial ties and a lot of kind of corruption as well between the Trump family, Jared Kushner. And obviously, he has his own Israeli ties, but also with the Gulf states. So there is like a real relationship there, and that's something which I think the Israelis really resent and have actually. It's a source of anxiety for them. But yeah, I don't think there's any doubt that obviously the Gulf was split insofar as it's very clear that Oman, Saudi Arabia, and then obviously one of Iran's like Pakistan and Turkey were all against this war very, very clearly. They did not support this war, whereas Bahrain, which is really it's really a non-player, but the Emiratis in particular, of course, which have increasingly military intelligence integration with the Israeli state, and obviously goes obviously they've got long-standing relationships which were undisclosed, but the Abraham Accords, obviously this diplomatic accord with between Bahrain in the Gulf anyway, Bahrain and the UAE and Israel. And yeah, the Emiratis, I think in the first weeks were extremely aggressive actually. But then I think the longer the war went on, they were very much humbled and brought back down to earth. But I think it came out the degree to which they became increasingly dependent on the Israelis. So I mean, the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu, the head of Mossad, the head of the IDF, I believe as well, actually went to the Emirates in this time, and they also visited them, and they also provided Israeli defense systems extensively to the UAE as well. And I think the Emiratis didn't want this disclosed because obviously that does have a significant cost, but at the same time the Israelis kind of did very much very clearly leaked it with the intention of trying to bind the Emiratis even closer to them and not allow them to play maybe this sort of more ambiguous kind of role. But I definitely, yeah, I mean, just to speak to your point, the Qataris, the Omanis and the Saudis were clearly dead against this. I mean, as I said earlier, the Emiratis, sorry, the Omanis and the Qataris were very outspoken for a diplomatic accord like before the war. And the Saudis actually, I mean, I think there was a lot of, and there's a lot of doubt about this. I think historians will have to pass this later, but There were various kind of like anonymous statements being attributed to officials in the administration for saying that like Mohammed bin Salman and Saudis were really raring and pushing for a war. I mean, I've spoken with friends of mine who, you know, who are from the Gulf and have a lot of insight into the region as well, and they were very kind of categorical that they believe this was basically leaks. So these were basically confected leaks in order to basically almost create a self-fulfilling prophecy where the Saudis would be pulled onto the American and Israeli side. And what actually happened is the Saudis resolutely kind of did resist this. And actually, we saw that, you know, really kind of further confirmation of that when we had this Operation Epic Freedom, where the Americans wanted to really kind of, you know, charge into the Strait of Hormuz and kind of, in a sense, pry it open by sheer force. And the Saudis said, no, this is not gonna, clearly they didn't believe it would work. And they said, we're not gonna allow you to use our airspace. And this actually forced that Operation Epic Freedom, not to be obviously, you know, mixed up with Epic Fury, to basically come crashing down in like 48 hours. You know, it was a complete flop. So, no, I think the role of the Gulf states, at least, you know, Qatar, Oman, Saudi, and Pakistan, along with Turkey, were extremely, extremely significant. And it's also indicative of why the Israelis have been increasingly kind of aggressive vis-a-vis both Pakistan and Turkey as well, because they themselves are also and threatening Turkey very directly, actually, sort of saying, you know, they're the next Iran or they're sort of this Sunni axis, which is now going to threaten us. So, no, I do think that was real because they just understood how destructive it is to the region. I mean, like, and Saudi was not really that badly affected because they could still actually, you know, export oil for the most part. I mean, significant amounts anyway, and they were benefiting from the higher prices. And yeah, Iran did attack, but minimally, like really compared to like it was really the Emirates. They've got, you know, like 2,500, 3,000, like, you know, sorties, you know, just like constantly just hitting them because they were very because and the Emiratis actually undertook, you know, aerial attacks on Iran. So and I think I mean, which was interesting to watch. I mean, I don't know ultimately what will come out of this, but I think it does show that the long term, which is quite obvious, the fact that they've bound themselves so clearly to so tightly to the Israelis is really kind of a strategic disaster in the long term. Because I mean, they're 100 miles away from, I mean, it's like, you know, really next door to Iran, like this huge neighbor, and you've basically tied yourself to this state, which really has this existential like campaign against the Islamic Republic. It's really, I think, gonna come back to bite them. Even if they have gotten certain dividends, I mean, the certain degree of immunity that they've got for their role, for instance, in the genocide, you know, the massive slaughter in Sudan, from which they've directly kind of profited through the gold trade and so on. So I mean, but it's gonna, I think, you know, it's gonna come back to bite them. And we've seen even the Emiratis like massively dialed down the public rhetoric, because I think they've understood, yeah, it's been a categorical failure, and we're going to have to live next to this neighbor. And Dubai is not a state that can be constant. I mean, look, it's overwhelmingly dependent on both like basically modern day indentured labor, and a kind of hyper sort of wealthy expat oligarchy for expertise and so on. And it can't, I know, and also just being seen as this safe haven for multi for sort of for basically multinational corporations and their capital. So yeah, you can't basically be constantly under threat or like have instability and drones flying over. It's just not feasible for their whole model, I mean, of Dubai and Abu Dhabi in particular. So I mean, you know, I think the Gulf was absolutely kind of instrumental, and I think that's kind of somewhat restraining Trump, even though it couldn't actually stop the war in the first place. Like they could have, you know, the war had to, in a sense, happen. Yeah.
Trump's alienated Europe. He's alienated Italy. I mean, he's put the prime minister in a real bind there, which, she deserves, right? But despite, kind of the American people may have turned against Israel, but the money and the weapons aren't going to stop, no matter who the president is, no matter which party it is. And the Democrats, I would argue, are probably worse than the Republicans on that count. But Israel's clearly been damaged. But kind of what extent do you think? I mean, I don't think Israel has the same, never had standing there, but it had, like, I think, the ability to threaten other countries, to frighten other countries. Has that been diminished? It seems like it has. It seems like there's kind of been the veneer has been taken off. course, I
Yeah,
said
I mean,
this
I
in
think, yeah.
2006 when Hezbollah defeated them too, and so
No, I mean, again, I think they're going to still very much be pushing in Washington really hardcore. But I think it's like I said earlier, I mean, they threw everything at the Islamic Republic, and it's very much managed to resist and actually inflict a huge kind of cost. And it just completely fell flat. So they'll continue to make that argument, but I think it's going to be just very difficult for them to make that argument and be taken seriously. I mean, I don't think they're going to for a minute, relinquish their designs on southern Lebanon or Syria for that matter. But yeah, I mean, and they clearly are going to continue to push like really sort of aggressive policies on sanctions and economic warfare. I mean, they still have a say. I mean, like I was just seeing today, and I knew this, a sort of a leading figure in the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, which is basically like an Israeli like surrogate. It's like basically like an advocacy group for the Israeli, for the Likud, like pretty much. That's what the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies is. It's not a think tank. It's it's basically an Israeli proxy. And he's in the negotiating team. He's part of the technical team that's going to be there. So I'm sure Miriam Adelson and various other, like Paul Singer and other big kind of Zionist donors to Trump, are still going to want to have some degree of say and have some degree of some guarantees. And they're try to spoil. They're going to act as spoilers, and they're going to try to ensure that. And you have this in the media circuit. I mean, people like Ben Shapiro and Mark Levin and people like that who are going to continue to advocate that. But obviously, I think they're in a difficult position because it has just so it's been a dramatic kind of failure. So, I mean, I think a lot of people do think of what a next round is going to happen. I mean, a lot of people that I'm seeing in Iran as well think very kind of convinced that there will be a next round, and actually, in the United States is getting ready for that. I really don't know. I mean, to be honest, I mean, I have obviously severe doubts because obviously during two rounds of negotiations, the US has attacked Iran. I mean, so I'm not. I wouldn't. I wouldn't be dramatic. I wouldn't like remarkably surprised if that did happen. I just don't see the appetite for it, and I just don't see the appetite for them taking it to the next level to fundamentally change, what is the settlement post-war. I just don't see how that can be changed without a massive ground invasion and all these sorts of things. I just don't see how that can shift there. So yeah, I guess I think the Israelis are going to continue to push the boundaries in Lebanon and Syria. They're going to continue to be extremely aggressive on Iran, I have no doubt, and they're going to try to act as spoilers. But like you said, I mean, amongst the American public, there's no appetite for it. Amongst even the right, part of the right in the United States, a lot of conservatives are dead against this and see this as a disaster. And I don't think we've ever seen it so publicly legible or so publicly kind of with such ease stated that, US interests and Israeli interests are not one and the same. And there's like often a significant difference between them. And whether we understand those terms or not, I mean, that's a talking point which is increasingly palatable to many and increasingly said when something, I think previously you couldn't say that, I think. It was like, it wasn't sort of the said thing. I mean, obviously people like John Mearsheimer and others would constantly insist on this, but it wasn't part of like the mainstream kind of discussion where this kind of like crazy ideas, I know, Israel is the defender of Judeo-Christian civilization, the region, and whatever. I mean, these are all under pressure, and I think, yeah, I mean, we have to see. I mean, I would be, I would be foolhardy to kind of to say otherwise, because like we have seen the MOU repeatedly kind of tested, and we have seen hostilities breaking out, but they have so far been contained. And the Israelis at any minute will try to obviously to exacerbate that. And like, and again, I think even Vance said this. He said like, there's going to be people who want to destroy this, who want to, who don't want this to come to fruition, who are constantly remarking on every single twist and turn in the negotiations. And I do think like a lot of the Democrats, like I said before, who are lambasting the MOU. And people like Sullivan and others who have come out and been highly, highly critical of it, I mean, they claim they're not for the war, some of them at least, but some of them are actually, yeah, like you said, they're more hawkish and they're like,
Oh,
oh no,
absolutely.
should have done this, should have done that, if we'd done this, or we could do this. So, I mean, and they're accusing him of Trump of capitulation. They're trying to goad him. It's the same like in the course of the Syrian civil war, where the only time kind of the Democrats like applauded Trump is when he was basically when he finally like he bombed Syria basically, and that was the only time. Oh, this and this is seen as being presidential, So he's going to be under a lot of pressure, and he is. I mean, this is why he's kind of, I guess, vacillating between conciliatory messages and then kind of like outrageous, apoplectic kind of messages, because he himself is getting pushed from multiple directions.
Vance has said things about Israel that if he were like on an American campus, he would be arrested and expelled. And I mean, in the recent elections, Israel was the biggest issue. I mean, that's why I think the establishment Democrats like Schumer and Jeffries are really kind of discredited at this point, because in all of these elections, that's become kind of a major issue, AIPAC and Israel, along with, kind of the American economy. Last thing, because we could go on and on and on. Going forward, how do you think Iran, like, what's its position now? Even though it suffered, fairly immense destruction, it seems like it's in a better position now. We didn't even talk about the nuclear issue, which is interesting. But in a sense, has Hormuz replaced kind of the nuclear issue as a deterrent? And like going forward, what do you think Iran, kind of how is Iran seen? What can it do going forward? Does it have kind of more opportunities, more openings, more options?
Yeah, I mean, like as I said, there's a debate within Iran about those who say we need to use this and capitalize on it in order to basically have the dividends now, and these need to be economic. So I think Ali Boff himself like said this. He said, in a sense, we need to take the baton from the young men who were basically shooting the missiles in the trenches to now like the broader population that's obviously suffering economically. And I think many in Iran do understand this, but also they're not naive. So I think like maybe a difference between a figure like Ghalibaf and Araghchi compared to those on sort of the center right, more technocratic, like neoliberal side of the political establishment, I think historically they could be quite naive about like Western designs at times. Whereas I think now actually the attitude is we don't basically give anything without first like verifying that it's taken place in many ways. I mean, so there's very much the sense that we're only going to give something if we're getting something and it's kind of verified. We're not doing it on sort of, woolly promises of the future. So I think that's a quite significant kind of shift. There was also very clear indications to China actually. So previously, like in 2013 and following the JCPOA, when you had this sort of right centrist government in Iran, as soon as you had the JCPOA, they were just looking to like European capital, basically, and American capital. I mean, this is going to basically solve our problems for the most part, this sort of influx of foreign capital. Whereas now they're saying, okay, we need investment, we know this is, we're actually going to be, they're not hostile necessarily to European investment, but I think Europeans actually are completely irrelevant now compared to like the JCPOA era. They're completely, like, for the most part, irrelevant. But like, we're not hostile to sort of Western capital, like maybe coming into Iran under certain conditions, but we're looking to much more kind of closer strategic cooperation with China. So there's also that clear kind of indication to rebuild and so on and so forth. And obviously there is a strong relationship there. Obviously people can maybe overstate it and almost, paint them as some sort of constellation of sort of this sort of axis of resistance, including China, which is to overstate it. But I think like at least in Tehran, I don't know what the appetite is in China itself, but the appetite in Tehran is definitely to have a much more and even more sort of deeper strategic kind of relationship with China. At least that's the indication so far, and I think Ghalibaf has said this, as have others. So yeah, I think they're gonna tread carefully. They're gonna see what the they don't trust the Trump administration at all, as they shouldn't, and they're gonna basically say, what can we actually get out of this? And I think, yeah, like I said earlier, the Strait of Hormuz is it's basically like a spoil of this war. I mean, they've shown that they can shut it down, they can show they can control the transit from it, and they want something. It might not, it'll be negotiated or kind of a collaborative kind of arrangement with Oman, but they're not gonna relinquish. I think it's very unlikely they're gonna relinquish that, because it's like you said, they've paid this very high price. And also, I think they'll just be hammered by people at home for doing that. The nuclear file is obviously something else. We've already seen Trump shift on that, which I do think is important, because before he was kind of like just zero enrichment, zero stockpile, and you have to basically ship it out and the Americans are going to come in. And I actually think, one day again, historians will have the full story here. But I think, when we had that massive incident following the two pilots who had been shot out of the sky in Iran, that clearly was an operation in and around Esfahan to try to see if they could either put a landing strip and try to seize the uranium. And it was a disaster. And I think that actually really marked a major shift as well, because I think that's when Trump realized that that's not doable, like we saw like a shift of gear, like a meaningful one. So I think that was really important kind of too. And then Trump then shifted to saying, okay, they can downblend it under the supervision of the IAEA, and they're like, maybe Americans also have some sort of role here, whatever. So we have seen shifts on that. I mean, whether that will come to a resolution, who the heck knows? I mean, because it works maybe for Iran to just keep it like strategically ambiguous. And if they can still export their oil, if the waivers are in place and there's basically selling oil to China or elsewhere in East Asia, then they might actually be happy. Whether it's going to kind of result in some grander kind of bargain, I don't know. And a lot of people have obviously pointed this about Trump himself, and you know this better than me, that Trump is quite good at this sort of first initial stage, maybe of getting some kind of symbolic agreement, but then often doesn't really mean anything. It's the same with like North Korea. It's the same in lots of other cases where he comes out rhetorically. The only difference, obviously, to East Asia is that you have this Israeli factor, which is constantly just going to be pushing for this maximalist aims, which for sure now have been very much tempered and like humbled. But that's not to, you know, they're going to keep pushing. I mean, they are committed to their agenda. And they're going to keep pushing for that. But yeah, to see whether this really converts into something more meaningful, we have to see. But yeah, Iran has to obviously get these economic dividends from this, because there's no point fighting this war if it's going to basically, you know, if the Iranian economy is going to continue to be in this really quite terrible shape, and you're going to have, yeah, there's huge levels of discontent and people being thrust beneath the poverty line. That's not going to work.
I don't believe, kind of anything will come of it long term. But for the moment, I mean, the limits of U.S. power really have been exposed.
Totally, yeah.
And I think, Iran understood that. North Korea has understood that, right? I think the message to a lot of smaller countries is to develop a nuclear program, so it'll be, kind of going forward. But Iran, we didn't even talk about the kind of internal politics in Iran and the repression or anything like that. But I think, if you want to see a different world, then what Iran's done is really important here. So I
Yeah,
learned.
you can't have freedoms and civil liberties if your country's been, you know, attacked and destroyed, and you have basically foreign imperialist aggressors trying to balkanize and, you know, induce a civil war. So, I mean, if you want to see Iranians like have a better life, then yeah, how about stopping imperialism, trying to like destroy the very conditions of, you know, the conditions of life in there, you know,
Well,
like, yeah, as they've done in Gaza.
for that decade after the first Gulf War, I think those sanctions were kind of Saddam Hussein's kind of ally, right? He could always point to that, right? So I always learn more from talking to you like for an hour than I do, when reading the Western media. So I really
Likewise.
appreciate it. In addition to your books, you've also written extensively in like New Left Review and A Sidecar. Is that's the
Yeah, London Review of Books, yeah,
London
check
Review of Books,
it.
right? All over the place. Do a search. But you're the go-to guy. You better be careful though, because apparently they're trying to get rid of Treta Parsi. So
Yeah.
the
I'm not
message.
coming to the US, so don't
Oh,
worry,
that's
yeah.
good. That's
I'm
good.
staying.
Yeah.
No, I don't have a visa. I don't have a visa. They won't let me in, I don't think.
Yeah. It's funny. I mean, this guy is like really establishment, Quincy Institute, all this kind of stuff.
No, because he's effective. He's very good at what he does.
Yeah.
He's
I mean,
very
I've
effective.
actually just in the past like 3 or 4 months to see him change because, when it started, I think he was being trying to be reasonable and tempered. And now, he's saying stuff very similar. I mean, he's, looking at reality. So it's really interesting.
Well,
Thank you.
he's got a project. I mean, he's got like his project, I think, is, you know, he's a political animal, like in many ways. He's trying to like affect power in a meaningful way. And he's trying to get obviously the right and the left who are opposed to these, you know, foreign adventures. He's trying to get buy-in so then he can actually, you know, and I think that's a really important thing. I think it's like, I mean, like, you know, I'm like an academic, I'm sticking to that. Obviously, I follow these things, but what he's doing is, yeah, he's really trying to intervene, I think. And that's obviously why the Laura Loomers of this world and these other like unhinged lunatics, and like, yeah, the Israel lobby. I mean, to be honest, a lot of people, non-Iranians, won't know this, but basically, the Israel lobby and other elements, you know, anti-regime elements in the States, had basically really tried to tarnish him, and they tarnished his prior organization, which he founded, NIAC. And they basically tried to paint it as like a regime lobby for years and years and years. So they really tried to like blacken his reputation and his name. And he's actually paid a, he's done really well because he's very good at what he does, but he's paid actually a quite a heavy price, to the point that many like Iranians, when they hear the word Nayak, I mean, they really kind of have a very kind of visceral reaction because they just really have smeared him. Like they've smeared him like incredibly, like, you know. But he's a machine. I've got to give it to him. He just is like interview after interview after. I can't do that, you know. But he's doing it. He's like a he's sort of a one man sort of I don't know, sort of lobbying organization, active, sort of very, very, very proactive by doing really important work.
This whole thing is so weird. I mean, it's converted Tucker Carlson into this like kind of statesmanly figure, right? And made him, I mean, he's reprehensible, but on this particular issue, he's taken the lead, and the Democratic Party and the so-called left hasn't done anything. And so they've
No.
created this area. So Tucker Carlson and Marjorie Taylor Greene and Thomas Massie. I mean, if you asked anybody to talk about the three most important kind of critics, it would probably be those three. And they've, in a sense, kind of legitimated, maybe not legitimated, but given Iran a level of credibility among Americans that it hadn't had before.
Yeah, but
Tucker
you think
Carlson
also,
will speak, you know, it's insane. It's really surreal and bizarre.
I think they're responding to their audiences. I mean, at the end of the day, like, people don't want this. They don't
No,
want their
no.
tax dollars going to like murdering young girls in Iran or Gaza. I mean, they've just
And
had
paying
enough.
450 for gas, you know, or whatever.
Paying $4.50 to $5 for gas and for what? I mean, you know, and they don't see. I think increasingly people do understand that despite being bombarded, you know, for decades with propaganda against Iran about, you know, how great Israel is, how it's the only democracy in the Middle East, all of this kind of that's nonsense. But people really have seen through it. And I mean, yeah, the Gaza genocide, I think, was central to that demis. I mean, obviously, there have been years and years of grassroots, incredible kind of activism, which people have been doing, the Palestinian movement, BDS, and so on. But I mean, the Gaza genocide, I think, was just so, it was just, you know, it's a crime of our century, you know. And I think that's, you know, there's no longer any pretense. I mean, I think it's also becoming a fault line in lots of arenas, like politically as well. If you're not able to call it a genocide, or if you support Israel, that's like determines like your character, who you are, your values. You know, I think a lot of people take that to heart.
It's going to crack up the American political system. The Democratic Party is headed for a major crack up right now because of this. So, anyway, as always, appreciate it. Hopefully, the next time we talk, it will be a little rosier, little, you know, won't be quite as bleak. Hope to see you before too long, and appreciate it so much.
Likewise.
Iskander Sadiqi, the go-to guy on Iran and what's happening today. Book Revolution and His Discontents, and he's published and on podcast. Just do a search on him. So thank you so much as always,
Pleasure.
Iskander. If you're watching this, check out the Green and Red podcast. Unlike Scott, I don't have all this stuff memorized, so just do a search on it. But we're on all the social media. You can we're on Patreon if you want to send a few bucks along, and we're on YouTube and all kinds of platforms. So check it out because you get great stuff like this. So thanks so much. I'm Bob Bezanko, and see you next time, and go out there and cause trouble and misbehave. Whoops.